Hello and welcome to a new episode. Dagmar Hofestedt is your host today in our series, Can the Records Be Trusted? Today, we dive deep into the archive with someone who's dedicated their whole life to understanding, teaching, and applying the principles of archiving, Dr. Trudy Huskamp-Petersen from the United States. In this case, a short biographical excursion is in order, I think, because Trudy has been working in archives for a long time, one might even say a lifetime. And how did you start, Trudy, thinking that archiving was your calling?
I needed a job. It wasn't any more sophisticated than that. I had an undergraduate degrees in English and history, and I got a job in archives and then realized, of course, I needed graduate school in history, which I did. But as soon as I was in an archives and started to research, and I could read all the secrets of 30 years ago, and I knew the gossip from 30 years ago, I thought, oh, this is the way I want to spend my life.
So archiving found you more so than you had an
Absolutely.
Idea. Yeah.
Absolutely.
That sounds great. I would consider that a classical archival career. You went to the National Records Administration of Records and Archives in the United States, right?
That's right. I did.
And what did you do when you became part of the National Archives in the United States?
I probably had every job you could have as an archivist, but I started working with presidential records. And I worked with oral histories. The one that then was really significant was I became the chief of the bureau that had the records of the Native Americans, what we call the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so I learned a lot about what people really need out of an archives and how they need it to be given to them.
All right. So what do people really need in an archive?
Well, in that case, we needed to show people that they really had been part of a Native American group, such that they then could get the benefits of being a part of the Native American group that was getting federal benefits. And so we did a lot of genealogical work. Not always easy, but...
In a way, that was already a rights question, right? Having the right to access benefits by proving through the documentation that you're part of a tribe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but then the United States wasn't enough. You somehow then got involved in international archiving. How did that step come about?
Well, I was always interested in foreign archives and that sort of question. I had dropped out of the archives or taken a leave of absence and had a Fulbright scholarship in Finland and taught history in Finland for a year and came back. And out of that, of course, I started to know Finnish archives. I knew people in Scandinavia, but I also became involved in the International Council on Archives, which is based in Paris.
Yes, this is the worldwide organization representing state archives, but also non-government archives and really our lobby organization for archives all around the world, right?
Absolutely. And it began, as you say, right after World War II, when it was important to begin to rebuild the archives of Europe. And so it was established then and then grew to include other government archivists from around the world, then became a part of the associations of archives around the world. And then you added the archives of organizations, businesses, and individuals.
But your interest led you pretty soon to really focus on the intersection between archives and human rights.
Absolutely.
How did that come about?
Well, as I said, I started with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and understanding the Native American issues. When I decided to retire from the National Archives, there was a job advertised in Budapest, Hungary, where the Open Society Archives was to be created. And so I applied and got hired and went to Budapest, Hungary for 3.5 years. I was the first executive director of the Open Society Archives there.
And that was in the 1990s, after
yes,
the fall of the
right.
wall and
Absolutely.
The end of the Soviet
Absolutely.
Empire.
Yeah. And after I had done that for 3 years and the thing was up and running, I started looking for other places. And at that point, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was looking for someone. And so I moved to Geneva and established the archives of the High Commissioner. I went all over the world looking at records of refugees and bringing them back. And when I had done that, I needed to get back to the United States for family reasons. And so I decided, let's see if there's jobs out there that I could do as a contractor. And so that's what happened.
And that's what happened for a long time. That's how we met. Mm-hmm. Full disclosure, we've met each other in Colombia and in Tunisia, I think. And that's what became your career, to help people in conflict situations create archives to document violations and then maybe use them in transitional justice mechanisms.
Right. I think the couple of things that I've done that are important, I worked for 3 years off and on with the police archives in Guatemala to try to get them in a state where they could be used for evidence in court cases and making sure that there was a chain of custody that the lawyers would recognize and could be used. I also did about 3 years worth of work in the Marshall Islands, looking at the Nuclear Claims Tribunal records there, and again, getting those in a state where they could be used and preserved. So those are two of the big ones. I also worked for truth commissions. I did work for the International Criminal Court for Rwanda. I did work for the Special Court in Sierra Leone. So a lot of different places around the world.
If you look at all these conflicts and you look at them through the perspective of the records, is that like a common thread? Is that like a theme that connects them, even though the conflicts are so different?
Well, records are records, and they reflect what an organization does. And that could be good, and it could be very bad, depending on the nature of the organization and how it sees itself. Whether the records are the same or not, yeah, they kind of are. Everybody has to control money, one way or another. Everybody has to control who works with them and for them. And you see this even in paramilitaries, that they have to know where am I going to get the ammunition? How am I going to pay for it? Who are the fellows that I can trust to go out on a patrol? So it isn't just organizations like governments or businesses or faith-based organizations, but it's also all kinds of NGOs and other kinds of irregular groups that have to control how they're working.
Yeah, and so how, where the money goes and how to document what they're doing.
Right, absolutely.
For their own assurances, right? So you mentioned the word truth commissions, and in 2005, you actually published a report that was called Final Acts, A Guide to Preserving Truth Commission Records. Mm-hmm. So what prompted you to write this? Was there a need to preserve the records?
Well, what had happened was I had been asked to go to South Africa and give advice to that truth commission as it was closing up as to what should happen to its records. And then eventually I was asked if I would go to Honduras and help that truth commission. In the meantime, of course, I had looked at the Guatemala issue, which is very complicated because the truth commission records did not stay in Guatemala. They went to the United Nations. And so I started to see this pattern around the world that people really needed to think through what was going to happen to Truth Commission records, because these are temporary bodies. They don't last. And yet sometimes the government doesn't want to or shouldn't probably take them over. In the case of South Africa, of course, the government could take it over. It was a post-apartheid government. It wasn't going to go back. If you looked at Guatemala at the time the Truth Commission ended, well, it was pretty dicey, and it wasn't at all clear that the records would be preserved if the government got their hands on them. So I sat down to figure out what was going on in the various countries that had Truth Commissions. There were about 20 at that time. There are somewhere around 40 by now. And I wrote to every one of them and asked them what had happened to the records, and then tried to develop some models for them to use as they came to a close. My real issue was, could you at the beginning, when you start to set up a truth commission, think about what's going to happen at the end? Don't just plunge in. You're going to be collecting incredibly sensitive information if you're doing your job at all well. And so at the end of that time, who do you want to hold it and under what conditions?
I mean, it's a question that is kind of wrong to ask an archivist, but why do you think it's so important to keep these records? Because it's temporary bodies. You could say that information was exchanged and so it's over. So why do these records need to persist?
Well, they need to persist for a number of different reasons. First of all, in many countries, the fact that the Truth Commission has ended doesn't mean that litigation has ended. And so some of the records will be used for years as evidence in court cases. But then we have the history of the country and how it came to be what it is now. I like the epigraph that the El Salvador Truth Commission had in its final report, which is simply, "All these things happened among us." Aha, that's who we are. That's how we got there. But then on a personal level, you're going to have testimonies of grandparents. I don't know what my great-grandmother sounded like. I have no idea. But somebody in the future is going to know what a great-grandparent sounded like because the testimony was recorded. That can also be used, for example, not only for history of the country, but for linguistics. How did voices change? How did word usage change? How was the difference in speech between women and men at that time? So there are all these things, if you start thinking about it, that are beyond history, that are beyond law, but take you into all kinds of uses for records where you know precisely the date, you know precisely the time, and you know precisely who was the speaker, gender, age, and so forth.
There are purposes and uses of these records that we don't even know right now. And that's why there is fundamentally a need to preserve them, but also because it's part of the history of each of the countries, right?
It's part of history of the countries, but usually it also affects the countries around them. For example, let's take Sierra Leone. Much of that conflict was stirred up by the president of Liberia, who was eventually convicted by the special court in Sierra Leone and is now in prison in England. But you see this all over, that a conflict doesn't really stick within the borders of a country usually. Yes, sometimes. And yes, some truth commissions truly are national in scope. But even a national truth commission like the one in Canada that looked at the schools where Native children were brought together forcibly and educated to be good little Canadians had a lot to do with the Vatican and the Catholic churches that ran many of the schools in Canada. Conflict does not, in my experience, stay very well within one border.
And then the records can make these connections when you compare them to other collections of the force. So the Truth Commissions were one of the transitional justice mechanisms that you found interesting. Mm-hmm. And 3 years later, in 2008, you looked at the courts, right?
Right.
Temporary courts and permanent records. Issues were the same there, that the access question hadn't been resolved?
Oh, they are still not resolved today. That's one of the issues. We have a couple of different kinds of international courts. We have the ones that were created by the UN itself, and that would be the Court for the Former Yugoslavia and the Tribunal for Rwanda. Then there are what are called hybrid courts, and that's Sierra Leone, where the UN and Sierra Leone made an agreement to create this court. Then there is the court in Cambodia, which is a hybrid court in my view, but it was established in the courts of Cambodia and is called by the Cambodians an internationalized court rather than a hybrid court. Then we have court for Lebanon, which is another UN court. And then we have one for Kosovo, which is yet one more very odd sort of legal background. So they're all quite different. But in each case, there's nobody who is really responsible. What you have when you have a national truth commission, somebody in that country is going to have to take care of it. Leave aside the Guatemala and El Salvador and Burundi cases, which are very different, and the UN stepped in. But I think that when you have everybody responsible, i.e. the UN and the nations, you actually have nobody who takes responsibility. And so what we have is the tribunals close, the records are there. Who's going to make the access decisions? Who's going to take responsibility in the long term for preservation? And that has not been sorted out by the international community and needs to absolutely desperately right now, because five of these six are in some process of closing.
And that's why you were in September at the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights and made sort of an argument in the small online conference for access regulations.
Absolutely. Because we really need to figure out what in the long term this is going to be and who is going to make those kinds of judgments. It's one thing if you have the copy of the court records that are public that is sitting in Sierra Leone or is sitting in Belgrade. Those countries can do with it what they want. But the one that the UN holds, that's all of our records. That's the community of nations having decided this needed to happen. And so who in the community of nations is going to then decide how to preserve and how to make it available for the public?
And you made that case quite forcefully in September 2024 in Geneva at the High Commissioner for Human Rights. So as a final question, we talked about all these mechanisms that date back to the decades before, end of apartheid, 90s, the zeros. And in the last 10 years, though, there has been a lot of new documentation, digital documentation to ongoing conflicts. And I was just wondering, with all your archival experience, right? So do you get excited about all this huge amounts of data? Or does it feel overwhelming to have, to have to archive such a phenomenal amount of never before seen data from such different contexts?
It's a challenge, but it's a very positive one. I worked in the U.S. National Archives for 20 years. The U.S. National Archives started taking electronic records in 1966. This is not the newest game in town. Of course it's changing. It's changing all the time. AI right now is the big hot topic. But I'd point to another one, and that is, how do you take care of the data of genetic testing? Let me give you a quick example. In Chile, the families of the people who are still missing from the conflict during the Pinochet years wanted to have their DNA recorded such that if in the future remains are found, they could be matched to them and they would know that it is part of the missing. They didn't really trust the Chilean government to take care of this. So they turned to the International Committee of the Red Cross, and the DNA samples taken from families of the missing in Chile are in the archives of the International Committee of the Red Cross. So it isn't just data, but it is all kinds of new phenomena that are coming into archives, and we're going to have to learn how to deal with it over the long run. It is massive. The massive electronic data that come out of, for example, the U.S. President's office are amazingly large. But the tools are also going to come along. I have faith that we can solve these problems. Preservation is not a problem to be solved. It is a process to be managed, and we keep managing it as the world goes on.
Thank you very much, Trudy Huskamp-Petersen, for sharing all your experiences and all your archival expertise in this talk. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.